Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, Jean-Marc Grodi, and here on EWTN, we have this great privilege once again to come together and hear a story, a conversion story. We're joined by Kevin Schinkel, former Nazarene, and many other things. As always, we say that the stories are very complicated, many backgrounds, many twists and turns, but it's great to have you here tonight, Kevin.
Well, welcome. I appreciate it. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you to talk about your story and talk about story, what we were discussing beforehand, just the reality. We're all on a journey.
Yeah.
Our life is an adventure. That's an act of faith to see it that way, to see it in God's terms. And so we're excited to hear yours. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share it. My journey kind of began, I like to say that I was a nun before nuns were cool.
Sure.
I was baptized in the Church of the Nazarene very young, at the age of 5, I believe. My parents had joined a couple years before. I grew up in Tucson, Arizona. Mm-hmm. And neither one of them had been churched growing up. It was an interesting experience. Neighbors had gotten them into it. They felt welcomed. They felt good. There was only one problem as it developed over the course of a couple of years. They smoked, and they smoked a lot. And the Nazarene, I remember the Nazarene pastors that were these two, Pastor Hayslip and Pastor Cumberland, and they were very nice, good men, but they were haranguing my parents constantly about smoking. One even brought up, I remember I was 4 or 5 or 6 maybe, and it brought over a plaque to put on the wall. It was a broken cigarette butt, and it was stop this type of thing.
Yeah.
And that turned them off. Without anything to fall back on, any really formation of faith, they were like, why are we? We don't want to be harangued.
Right.
And so by the age of 7 or 8, we were out. Mm-hmm. We were done. And I never went to church. We never went to church as a family. We never discussed God. We never discussed faith. It wasn't atheistic. It wasn't even agnostic. It was just
none. Yeah,
none. But as I can see, I think we'll share here. The there was a journey that we're going to talk about here. That the seeds were being planted at every step of the way. The first brush with Catholicism came in college. I had never met any Catholics that I was aware of. I'd never stepped foot in a Catholic church other than growing up in Tucson. You would take the field trips every year in grade school to the mission, Santa Fe or Del Boc, which I would encourage anyone to go to if you're in Tucson. It's one of Father Kino's missions from the Spanish in the 1700s. But so you would go to that. But there was nothing Catholic about that. It was historical.
Right.
So I get to college. I go to Hillsdale College in Michigan, which... while it's not Catholic, some would say it's the best Catholic school in America. It's an amazing school with a great liberal arts tradition and a tradition of faith, but not one that's really all that present, per se. But they've always attracted a lot of Catholics. And being in Michigan, there's a lot of Catholics in Michigan. I'd say right now, if I hear the number, 30 to 40% of the students at Hillsdale are Catholic, and 50% of the faculty at least are Catholic. But the friend group I fell into, a lot of similar interests, sports, and a guy now who's a great sports writer, he became a good friend, and they were all, I wouldn't say hardcore, I mean, maybe hardcore Catholic, in that they grew up in these Catholic environments. Mm-hmm. And let me backtrack for a minute. You know, during that period before I get to college, I was really certain, I was very interested in more so than a lot of my friends, in kind of political thought in who we are and who we're supposed to be. And I really fell into kind of a libertarianism, extreme libertarianism. Mm-hmm. I became a real devotee at a young age of Ayn Rand. And I remember reading, like, Atlas Shrugged and the speech, John Galt's speech, and all about the exaltation of the individual and, basically, don't tread on me, but, we need to really foster those who are the producers in society. And that, in Atlas Shrugged, one of the things they devote, they worship is the money symbol.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with me, this idea that, okay, freedom. I'm not going to tell you what to do. Don't tell me what to do. Let's just live our lives. And without realizing some of the destructive tendencies of that and where that ultimately leads and how that can lead to nihilism. Mm-hmm. But I get to Hillsdale, and I'm this kind of, Hillsdale's a conservative school and very, very libertarian, that's me. But I meet these Catholics. And suddenly, I started, there an old priest, Bing Crosby-esque priest, would come onto campus every Saturday night after dinner and to do mass in one of the school's conference rooms. And so there were times where I went with my friends, and mostly because we were going to go out afterwards. Yeah. And you know, I didn't want to be left behind, so yeah. I'll go to mass with them. But one of the things, I remember sitting there the first couple times, and there's smells and bells and all that. And even at that age, I felt different. I didn't know what it was. I felt something. And I remember that this priest started trying to recruit me then. He would send me cards and stuff. And then my friends were like, why is he trying to, you know, recruit you? I mean, why isn't he talking to us type of thing? But also, you know, along the dichotomy of my thought was, on the one hand, I want this extreme libertarianism. On the other hand, I really appreciated what Robert Frost called, you know, our gangs. You know, the gangs of people we want to be around. And, yeah. and it's not, it wasn't just a case of fitting in somewhere. It was just these groups that you want to be around, mm-hmm. from a cultural standpoint and other standpoints. And I really, you know, as I got to know the Catholics more, I thought, oh, there's this Catholic gang here. It's really interesting. And yeah. I would go back with my friends to, you know, they were still so into their Catholic high school, Monroe Catholic Central High School in Monroe, Michigan. And we would go to football games and things. And there was this kind of culture there. And I see it now. I live in the Philadelphia area now. And in Philadelphia, you know, you're a Father Judge guy, or you're a LaSalle guy, or you're a St. Yeah. Joe Prep guy. And those bonds and those gangs last forever. And there, so that this culturalism around the Catholicism, that it really appealed to me.
Yeah.
The family nature of it. I had an older sister, and that was it. I didn't come from a big Catholic family. There was just something, you know, I find that being a cultural Catholic, some people, you know, look down on that. I find it wonderful. Mm-hmm. I'll never be one from the standpoint of being born and bred in it. But there's nothing wrong with being a cultural Catholic. Mm-hmm. It is the culture is amazing. So I fell into that. I'm asking questions. All my friends were, again, as I mentioned, many of them were Catholic. But I didn't act on it. It was like, okay. And then ultimately, I stopped going to mass with them. You know, those particular friends graduated. I was a couple years behind. But I was questioning. I every now and then I would think about things in my own head. I left Hillsdale. I started a career in journalism in North Carolina, yeah. Rural North Carolina, where this is in the 80s, where Catholics were still nowhere to be found. It's obviously changed a lot in the state now. And I started experimenting a little bit, not every Sunday, but I was called to go to various churches just to check them out. And I remember the dumb experience, but in the things you remember, you know, they passed out the little plastic communion cups, and I didn't realize you were supposed to wait. I just got it and drank mine right at the beginning of service. Like, whatever, it's okay. This is strange, mm-hmm. but I knew I was looking for something, not in a real aggressive way. I'm no theologian. My life has not been one spent pondering deep theological questions. But I have thought about who we are and who we're meant to be, mm-hmm. and a relationship with God and what that should entail.
Yeah. Something definite and concrete. I mean, I was thinking about yeah. that with the libertarianism as well as with this Catholic tribe that you experienced, that there's our heart and our mind, they want something definite. And
yes.
we kind of live in a world of kind of these vaguenesses, and sometimes it clamps down on something just because it's definite and concrete.
Yeah.
A definite belief, a particular identity and tribe. We want that. We have a yearning for that.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And it's there, even if we can't articulate it, we can't verbalize it.
Right.
It was like being in mass for the first time. Mm-hmm. There's something going on here. Yeah. I don't understand it, but there's something going on here. Yeah. And, you know, and you hate to be, I know some people question, oh, you know, faith by feel. Well, sometimes that's important. You know, what am I really feeling? And, mm-hmm. and how does it manifest itself, or and how will it manifest itself? Mm-hmm. So, again, that was one of the seeds that was planted. Again, just the kindness of an old priest was a seed that was planted. Mm-hmm. So I experimenting some. I remember dating a girl in North Carolina, a young woman. Whose family was very hardcore, I believe Baptist, but hardcore Protestant, and going to a revival of sorts with her and her family. And it wasn't Billy Graham or Oral Roberts, but it was someone who they told me was pretty well known. I don't remember the name. And he was given, you know, a long sermon. And afterwards, I remember being talking with her and saying, I don't remember what those questions were now, but I remember I've got some really questions for him. I need to reach out to him. And I never did. But again, it was starting to percolate that there are questions that I needed answers to. So fast forward, I moved down to Florida in the Tampa area, the old Tampa Tribune. And I lived on Clearwater Beach for a while and went to a beautiful Protestant church there called Chapel by the Sea, which I always loved the name. And it was right on the bay. And you know, it was a great feel. But what I found, there was nothing there to keep me. There was nothing there that was, it was maybe holy, but not enough where I really wanted to be there every Sunday. But I wanted to be somewhere. So I meet the woman who would become my wife, Barbara, and she's a cradle Catholic, big Irish Catholic family, and we work together. And, you know, no matter what, she never missed Mass. Every Sunday, no matter where we were, if we could be traveling, she was going to go to Mass. It might be this 6 o'clock Mass, the p.m. Mass, but we were not going to miss Mass. She never pressured me to go. She never really even asked me to go, but I went. And it started, again, this idea that it felt right, which is, again, it's not a road to, you know, it's not a St. Paul moment, you know, where the lightning bolt were, but it was just, it felt right. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't remember specifically how I made the decision that it was time.
Yeah.
But I did. And I remember telling Barbara, I think I want to convert. And she was like, you know, listen, don't do this for me. There was no, we weren't certain we were going to get married at that point. And there was no, it wasn't, you know, you've got to convert before we get married. It wasn't like that. One of the things, though, that I developed a relationship, you know, throughout this journey, I've collected priests, really amazing priests.
Yeah.
And some are really well known. Others are just regular, you know, parish priests. And there was one in St. Petersburg, at our church in St. Petersburg, who was just so energetic and so just a good guy and could explain things in very clear and understandable ways and was so passionate about the faith and loved people. And I got to be friends with him. We would socialize. We would go out on boats and hang out. And you know, that was another big seed that was planted. And so I decided to enter RCIA. And my wife was my sponsor. Barbara was my sponsor. And it was not a great experience. I mean, it wasn't bad. It was just sort of, okay, we go to these meetings, I think, Tuesday nights. And me and this other guy would sit in the back, joke around the whole time. And I don't fault the woman who did it was a very sweet woman. But there wasn't a great emphasis on teachings. And I'll be honest, I don't. You know, I went through RCIA and the vigil and being in there, and I still didn't fully understand that it was the true body and blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people have that because I think a lot of RCIA programs are run by really well-meaning people, but not necessarily great.
Yeah.
But again, this idea of the journey, and at any step of the way, I could have backed out.
Mm-hmm.
And a big one came literally a week or two before the vigil. Mm. When this priest, who I was so close with, left the priesthood immediately.
Oh.
And it was, I remember being in, you know, he told me, he called me and told me he was leaving and he invited me over to the rectory and, you know, he was in tears. I think I teared up. There was another person, a friend who was close to, and he was gone. Oh. But the weird thing is, for a lot of people that might have said, okay, you know, this is a sign. For me, it was like, okay, whatever. I mean, it was tough, well, from a friendship level.
Yeah.
But I didn't question that this was still the right thing to do.
Right.
And you know, and there was a funny story about the night of the vigil. I had some, you know, one good friend who was not Catholic. He joined. He wanted to come and show support, and I had a couple other Catholic friends. And it speaks to the kind of the Catholic communitarian aspect of it. After the vigil, we go to a nearby restaurant in St. Petersburg, and we're eating. And next thing you know, a pitcher of beer shows up on the table. And I look to the waiter, who's that? She goes, well, it's the owner. He was at Mass and saw you come into the church. He wanted to congratulate you. You know, okay, these are my people.
Yeah.
And so I'm in the church now, and I'm going to Mass. But I was not all in. In the sense that it seemed like the right thing. I was going to church, and that's it. There was no real deep yearning to really understand, get deeper and deeper and deeper into the faith. I was focused on my job.
You were in journalism at this time?
I was in journalism.
How did you get into that? I don't know, maybe we mentioned it earlier.
No, we didn't. I always wanted to be a journalist. Okay. I just I'll talk about this idea of tribes.
Yeah.
Because there is not it's changed tremendously. Journalism is not, and it's one reason I left. After getting to a pretty high level, I loved being in a newsroom. There was nothing more fun and exciting than being around journalists, reporters and editors trying to put out a newspaper every day. And all of that went into it. It was you could go through every emotion and in an hour. You're on deadline, you've got these big stories. I remember when the governor of New Jersey, I was off that day and I get a call. I was deputy business editor at the Star Ledger in Newark. Which is one of the 10 great one of the 10 largest papers in the country. We won 3 Pulitzers when I was there. But including the story I'm about to tell, I'm deputy business editor, but I'm with my daughter at our swim club on a summer afternoon. And I get a call from my boss saying, you got to get in. And the governor was going to make a big announcement. And it was when Jim McGreevy came out as gay. And the idea that, but we put together a newspaper in 6, 7, 8 hours that won a Pulitzer Prize for breaking news, because it was just like this idea of everybody just dropping everything, doing what needed to do. And journalists are odd people. They're in a good way. They're characters. They're particularly the great newsrooms. They were just full of characters and different type of people, but they were all obsessed with one thing, and that was being, telling great stories. Mm-hmm. And so I always wanted to tell those stories. Another quick sidelight, if I may. One of the things when I was in college, and still debating at that point, whether I thought I wanted to be a journalist. I'm not a journalism major. I'm a history and political theory major, English minor, because Hillsdale's a liberal arts school.
Right.
And part of me was saying, well, do you want to go to law school? Do you want to go into politics? I had opportunity. I'd worked for a congressman from Tucson in his D.C. office. And it worked for John McCain. But a guy named Harry Atkins, who was Hillsdale had the NAIA National Track Meet, which was a big deal. World-class athletes there in the summer. And I stayed in the summer for it, was an intern for a guy named Harry Atkins, who was head of AP Sports in Michigan. And he tells me a story one night on how it came to mind recently when Gordon Lightfoot died recently.
Yeah.
His famous song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which I knew then and loved. This is in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Harry told me that he had covered that for the AP. And some of the stanzas in the line, Gordon Lightfoot read his story, one of his stories, on an airplane and decided to write the song based on his story and use some of Harry's words as lyrics. And I'm thinking, how cool is this? This is just cool.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I loved being a journalist. I was in some amazing newsrooms. The Tampa Tribune, which unfortunately is no longer there, but it was a great newspaper. I went from there. I went to Bloomberg News when Bloomberg News was still relatively young, because I wanted to learn hardcore financial journalism. And that got great exposure with some of the best top CEOs in the country. And it was a good experience. Right. Then I got recruited to the Star Ledger and ultimately became business editor there. And like I said, the business section was considered one of the top 5 in the country. The sports section was, the overall newspaper was. And then I got recruited to go to the Associated Press in New York. And, every journalist wants to go either to Washington or New York. Mm-hmm. And it was, in headquarters versus, I was associate business editor, then quickly deputy business editor, then ultimately global business editor for the AP. Oversaw a staff of 150 reporters, 125 reporters, I should say, and editors around the world. And it was, It was great. I mean, I oversaw all the coverage for the 2008 financial meltdown for AP. Our stories would hit a billion people a day throughout the world. It was full of great fun people who were often questioning the same way I sort of question on bigger thoughts. But in these newsrooms, you had some freedom to pursue those, where I'm not sure you do in newsrooms today.
Right.
I think it's changed dramatically
for
all the reasons we don't necessarily need to get into. But I remember going to, I was commuting by train for where we live, and I'm riding home on the train one night, and there was a big story on abortion, and it was horribly unfair. I get it that in a secular newsroom, it's going to tilt a certain way. But the story was just so one-sided. And I called up, when I got home, I sent the managing editor for news, who was one of the great journalists in the country, I sent him a text saying, listen, Mike, take a look at this story. I think it doesn't fit our standards of just being balanced. Mm-hmm. He looked at it and said, Kevin, and I know we had plenty of discussions. He was a New York Jewish guy who was very liberal. Okay, but he knew where I was coming from, and he was interested in that. So we could have these discussions. He immediately said, "Yeah, the story is horribly unbalanced." It got fixed, and the coverage of this particular issue then got again. You don't expect at the AP for it to be pro. Pro-life necessarily.
But news, journalism.
But it was just the news. And I felt comfortable having that conversation, and it could change things. I'm not sure, and I'm not talking about AP, but I'm not sure you can have that conversation in many newsrooms these days.
It's amazing how that connection, sometimes even with people who are, very different beliefs than you, recognizing a fellow journeyer or a fellow truth seeker or a fellow person of integrity, there's a brotherhood there. There's a bond there that you're like, we get each other on that.
Yeah. There was another guy who's still there who very much is like that and very different angles coming. But you're right. It's the fellow, we're all searching for something. Yeah. So, I was blessed in that my wife had been a reporter, a very good, great reporter. Mm-hmm. But she ultimately, we decided, we couldn't have raised kids and both people being reported. So she scaled back and really focused on raising her daughters while I could go off and do all this other stuff. So again, I'm still going to church out there all this time. Yeah. But that first part in Tampa and to some degree Newark, it was just that.
Yeah.
But I will say my wife insisted, Barbara insisted, every Sunday that we say a family rosary. And it used to just irritate me to no end because there was a game on or I had to get the kids to practice or they wanted to play golf. There was something going on at that Sunday evening. Mm-hmm. But she insisted. And I really think that was a really big thing for both me, but also for our girls who are 28 and 25 and both are remaining faithful.
Yeah.
And again, one of those seeds that are planted.
Right.
The next one came when she really encouraged me to go to a retreat. And I thought retreats are just, guys are going to share their feelings and this is just stupid. I don't want to do small groups. I don't want to talk. I'm tired. I'm working 60 hours a week. But this retreat was one of the most amazing things ever. It was at the Malvern Retreat House in Malvern, Pennsylvania, outside Philly. And it's one of the largest, maybe the largest lay-owned retreat center and oldest in the country. Wow. It is a holy place. And you have men who have been going to retreats there for 50 or 60 years. It is a special place. And I could sense that the minute I drove in. But this particular retreat was the affiliated with the Knights of Immaculata, the Militia of the Immaculata.
Okay.
And it wasn't, I realized I'm not going to share any feelings. I don't have to talk. I can just listen. And I've been going now 16, 17 years, maybe 18. And we bring in, when I first started, there were about 75 men. And now it's about 350.
Wow.
And we bring in heavyweights. We've had Cardinal Burke. We've had Father Gately, Father Brian Bransfield. We've had just a whole litany of these amazing priests who come in and give 5-hour-long talks and do Q&As, and we do a lot of other activities. Yeah. And but at the first one, I remember I went to confession, and on the Sunday morning, after being there Friday night, all day Saturday, and just kind of being blown away, and I forget, it was a Father Mastriani who taught at Christendom for a long time, and he was hardcore. I mean, hardcore. Not, you know, in your face, you know, but just hardcore belief, and this is going to change your life type of thing.
Yeah.
And animated and fun and interesting. And that Sunday, so I went to confession Saturday night. That Sunday morning, I went to the gift shop and bought a rosary. It was the first time I had ever bought a rosary. And I said, almost in a doorway, I said a rosary for the first time in my life on my own.
Yeah.
And I just felt compelled to do that. I don't know how or why. And I've tried to say at least a decade every day since, often during my commutes. And I remember walking down the streets of Philly recently. I was, you know, doing a decade, and some woman came up and said, you know, that's really cool. My family used to say that type of thing. But it moved me in ways I'm still not sure. I can't really describe, but it's one more seed. I just felt compelled. This is an important way of connecting with God.
Yeah. Well, let's take a little break there. Something clicked there at that retreat, you know, with that rosary that you'd been saying reluctantly, you know, and they were inspired to pray it on your own. Let's take a little break and pick up there and again see how your faith continued to blossom from these seeds in the Catholic Church. Okay. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Kevin's story. I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org, we've got a whole archive of stories, but we'd love to hear yours as well. If you're a convert, we'd love you to connect with us at chnetwork.org to share your story. We'd love to hear it. So we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Kevin's story. See you then. Well, welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Kevin Schinkel, former Nazarene and many other things, and really appreciate your story so far, especially, again, we were talking during the break and you were sharing beforehand, you know, this journey through your journalism career and seeking the truth and the connections that you made with other journalists who had a similar ethic, a similar, you know, yearning for truth and integrity there. And we're going to circle back around that a little bit, but we left off. You know, you've come into the church, and like many, you came into the church, you know, following the threads of grace, but still not 100% sure why you're there, what you're doing. You talked about, you know, sort of reluctantly praying the rosary with your family, and then having this great retreat experience. That's where we left off. Pick us up back there.
Yeah, and again, that was where I literally said the rosary for the first time by myself ever. And I remember very clearly doing it. I remember it was a green rosary, emerald green rosary, and it was interesting because I was starting just shortly after that is when I moved to, you know, started working in New York. So I'm on a train every day. And I made sure to say the rosary on the train. The first thing I did, so, you know, when I got on the train at 6 a.m. to get to New York, was to say the rosary. And a couple of things happened. And, you know, New York is an interesting place in many ways. But began to say the rosary on the train, like I said. I started really reading a lot of spiritual books for the first time. By everyone from Cardinal Dolan to Archbishop Chaput to many others, Russell Shaw, and some of it was church history, but a lot of it was you know, George Weigel, these types of his second book, not Witness to Hope, but his second book on John Paul II, which picked up really covered a lot of the what happened in Poland and in the Soviet Union. It just blew me away. But I also, there was a great experience, the great church, one of the great churches in New York, St. Michael's, the Archangel, on 34th Street. We were on 33rd, on 34th Street. I had a 12:10 Mass, and I just sort of stumbled in. And, well, that's not true. First time I walked in, it was early in the morning on my way walking to work, and so this is just a really good place to pray for a few minutes before I entered the AP headquarters. And then I started going to Mass, 1210 Mass. And there's an amazing priest who I'm still in contact with. I spoke to him just recently, Father Miles Murphy, who was maybe the best homilist I've ever heard. And when I say Miles Murphy, everything you would, New York, Irish,
yeah.
Miles Murphy. But he would put together, he told one of the best homily I've ever heard in my life, he gave me about, and I'm going to paraphrase it, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but he's a chaplain for a group in the Holy Land, and the driver takes him on a side trip to this church, and it was, I forget the name of it, dedicated to our mother, and he walks in, and the church is all right, but he walks in, and the driver had been so excited about it, and he's on the footsteps, and the driver comes, Father, what do you think? And he said, well, it was very nice. He said, well, look at the cliff there, Father. And he goes, that's where we believe that when Jesus was being kind of accosted and forced to quit. And it was our Mother of Tears, I believe, was the church. Mm-hmm. And that when they're pushing him off, want to push him off the cliff, his mother was standing here and looked up. And she cried because she knew where the road was going. Hmm. Whether that was true or not, right. Doesn't matter. It's a beautiful story. Yeah. It's storytelling. Yeah. So Miles could put these homilies together. They're just astounding. And he's still a priest in New York. And just being around these heavyweights who were just so infused with the faith, and who were New Yorkers and all of that entailed, it was just a great experience. And so... But again, just the idea of making a habit, if not every day, 3 to 4 days a week, getting to daily Mass.
Yeah.
Was that idea of centering yourself and really bringing you closer. And again, drip by drip by drip.
Yeah. You came in, so again, like many people, you entered the church, again, not 100% know what you're doing, and probably not with a strong sense of a relationship with God at that point.
No, right.
Okay, so talk about, here now these years later, you've had this experience with the rosary, and going to Mass, what is your now looking back at that point, what are your reasons that you're Catholic now versus when you became Catholic?
It was, that's a hard question to answer. Yeah. It just is, when you throw everything about being Catholic, we're going to talk about the adventure and the journey.
Yeah, yeah.
Being Catholic is an adventuresome thing.
Yeah.
That appeals to people. I recently heard a podcast of Jordan Peterson and Larry Arn, the president of Hillsdale, mm-hmm. in which Peterson is saying, listen, if you don't pick up the cross is going to fall on you. Mm-hmm. But he says, it appeals, faith should appeal. And he wasn't talking specifically of Catholic faith, but I'll apply it there. Mm-hmm. When you look at the 2,000 years of history, when you look at the fact that the original Catholics were willing to die for this, and for those who question whether or not, and I know it's trite to say, but who question whether it really was redeemed, Christ really died for and came back, these people who knew him were willing to die
right.
for him. In a way, that's all I need to know.
Yeah.
But again, for 2,000 years, the Catholic Church is filled with these extreme heroes, but also these extreme villains and everything in between, and people searching. And, mm-hmm. and we talk about growing up in Arizona, where you had the Spanish fathers come through and endure all these hardships to try and convert, and built these incredible monuments that are still there.
Yeah.
That is a very appealing thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about it earlier the feelings in faith, right? There's mm-hmm. some connections there, where like as St. Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they rest
yes.
in Thee.
Yes.
So we have this restlessness, we have a yearning in our hearts, and the question is, what ideology, what philosophy, what theology, what institution, which one kind of matches up with that?
Yeah,
that explains this yearning that we have in our heart. And that's one of these big existential questions. Where do I find the explanation for that and the fulfillment of that?
Well, no, that is so true because, and again, the church has something for everybody. And, mm-hmm. and that's where I get frustrated sometimes when, Catholics on whatever spectrum, they want to, pigeonhole things. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, the word Catholic is universal.
Yeah.
And, we should be a model for the world and not embody the worst parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we do, unfortunately. But And it doesn't mean that these certain questions, theological questions, aren't important, and I leave that to the theologians to figure out. Mm-hmm. But on a lived day-to-day experience, it's an adventure being a Catholic. Mm-hmm. And it means there's ups and downs, and there's good things and bad things, and you know, but it's all part of it. It's exciting. It should be exciting. When you fully embrace being a Catholic, it's an exciting thing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't fully embrace it for a long time, but it was, again, hearing for, you know, again, I love stories. I told a lot of stories myself. It's when you hear these stories, when you read the stories of the saints, when you read the struggles, I've been fixated in the last couple of years because I work for a public relations firm now with, in Philadelphia called Divine and Partners. But one of my first clients was the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, who is, her conversion story is so rich and so powerful and so relatable from the standpoint of here she was, you know, a mother and a wife and a socialite and then ultimately a widower and her struggle. And I just love, you know, when she makes the final decision and she's going against her family and she's going to be destitute because of it, but she still says, you know, to the Catholics I will go and try to be a good one. Mm-hmm. Well, to me, that sums up so many things. It's part of my journey. I'm going to go be Catholic and I hope to be a good one. And that's enough.
Yeah. I was thinking earlier about how the choice to see your life as a story is a Christian act of faith.
Yeah.
Right? Because it has an author. You know, it's not, sometimes we slip into this view of our lives as if our faith is in one box over here, and then here's the rest of the life. It's sort of neutral. And we bring it in if we run into an ethical issue. But for the most part, there's the faith, and then there's the rest of the world. But if what we believe is true, there's no compartments.
That's right.
God is the Lord of all, and there's nothing that happens that's not either not part of his indicative or his permissive will. So it's a choice of faith to look at your life and choose to see it as a story and to accept the implications of that. And be open to, you know, Christ being the great protagonist with you in your story.
That's right.
You know, we need a savior.
Yeah.
Let's talk about journalism a little bit more, because, you know, that it brings up some interesting questions about our relationship to truth seeking, but also, you know, how we sometimes our truth seeking can get diverted into just wanting to kind of obsess over the details or things that aren't relevant to us. Talk a little bit about, you know, our relationship with truth as Catholics and even the journal, maybe as journalism has developed in our time.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the best journalists, and I think there are fewer of these, we're motivated by one thing, and that was to get to the bottom of something.
Right.
To really, to find out the truth as best you can do. And most stories never hit the full truth of anything. But you're searching for that. And you're asking questions. And you've got the mindset that I really want to find out. I really want to know. Mm-hmm. And then I want to tell the story. I want to put it out there in a way that people are going to be moved by it or angered by it, or they're going to have some reaction to something. And that's why there's all sorts of different types of journalism. There's feature journalism, there's investigative, all these things. But they're all searching ultimately to get to the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. Whether it's to get to the bottom of the motivation of somebody, you know, in a positive story, what makes something good and happy and you know, then certainly there's a lot of it that what makes, you know, what's wrong with the world. Mm-hmm. We need to expose what's wrong in the world. I think there are great parallels. It's interesting that a lot of, I don't think this is true anymore, but one of my first journalism mentors was when I was at the Chapel Hill newspaper, a daily newspaper in Chapel Hill. It had just been bought by Dow Jones, and the editor who came in had been a former Washington bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, had been Asian, or the editor and publisher of the Asian Wall Street Journal. And here he is, I'm 22, working for him in Chapel Hill, because he wanted to run a small paper. His wife wanted to get her a master's or a doctorate at UNC, and he was near retirement, so I'll do this. But he told me once, he goes, so many journalists from his generation were the sons of pastors. And I think there's a connection there, because again, you spend your life, if your father is searching for a truth in a way, it comes down to the son as well. And it's not, they're not searching for necessarily God, but they are searching for that. And so it's a natural extension. to do that. Now, unfortunately, I think journalism is changing to a large degree. There's social media has a lot to do with it. The way cable TV news is on all sides, where it's just, it's not reporting anymore. And I sound like an old grumpy journalist in saying this, old man. But there's less emphasis on finding the truth of the matter than there is on you know, just being provocative and getting sound bites and getting followers on Twitter and all of those things. And there's much more. I don't have a problem with aggressive, hard-nosed journalism. I don't care who the president is or who. Asking really hard questions is your job. And as somebody once told me, I think it was probably Fred, you know, if you can't go to the house after a plane crash and knock on the victims and ask for, probably, you shouldn't be in this business. Or if you can't ask the mayor, I mean, I hate to tell journalism stories, but a good friend of mine, the mayor of Newark, who ultimately went to prison, but he walked into the Star-Ledger newsroom one day, and George was a big guy, but he went up to, and it was smile on his face, but Pat started patting down the mayor, saying, "I know the money's in here somewhere, mayor, but where is it?" But the idea being that, you know, you have to do that. You have to ask hard questions. Mm-hmm. I don't think people are asking the hard questions anymore, very few. And instead, it's just ideologically driven, and it's soundbite driven, and it's social media driven.
Mm-hmm. Something other than truth. It's driven by something other than the desire.
And that's a dangerous place for the republic to be.
Yeah.
Because we were founded, I mean, journalism's always various trends and things. I mean, early journalism in this country was insane. But, you know, the country needs a great free press. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church needs really good journalism, people covering it.
Yeah.
Not in a way that's ideologically driven, but in a way that is asking questions that the faithful have.
Yeah.
And is producing stories. I mean, I almost use the word producing content. I hate that word. Mm-hmm. Producing stories that people want to read and that will help them on their journeys to, again, in a non-ideological way, but people who are just asking the natural questions. Who is this God?
Yeah.
Who is what is the Pope supposed to do? Why should I follow this? Mm-hmm. I don't get it. I don't see enough of that in Catholic journalism, to be honest.
Yeah.
And that's a sad thing because it's never been easier to get stories out, and so much of them, it's either irrelevant or harmful.
Yeah, it seems like, I think one of the marks of good journalism, again, whether secular or Catholic or whatever, is that it promotes virtue in the person.
That's right.
Now, but then again, what that means is that a person comes to believe what is true and good and beautiful, but not out of fear, not out of desire, not out of tribalism, but because it's true. They've made a decision to stick with what's true. And so we can certainly write and share in such a way that people are encouraged to be more truth-seeking, right? Mm-hmm. To have more of a hunger for truth. Or we can share the faith. I mean, we can do this in evangelization. We can share the faith in such a way that either leads people to be more people of passion, just sort of following, you know, their whims, or people who are making decisions to step forward in faith. And how we do it is important, right?
Well, you see that in journalism, certainly. You also see it in education. And yes. There's an example that, you know, I'm a big believer in Hillsdale College. I don't mean to proselytize for Hillsdale here. But the idea, you know, and yes, it's considered a conservative, you know, Christian school. Mm-hmm. But it's all about the true, the beauty, the good, the true, and the beautiful.
Yeah.
And my daughter who went there had that experience where, you know, the professors there are not indoctrinating you on, you know, whatever cause they believe in. And there was a great example of that. And those who are not conservative sometimes doubt that. Mm-hmm. But there was a story recently it was a very powerful read on a girl who spent her first year at Bryn Mawr and is a total liberal. But she was so opposed to just this feeling that they're just pushing things down my throat and that I'm not allowed to question and I'm not allowed to seek my own answers, that she ends up at Hillsdale. And she recounts a story in her first one of her first classes where she's reticent about bringing up an opinion that she knew would not necessarily be popular. Mm-hmm. And the professor pulls her aside after and says, "Don't do that again. I want to hear your opinion. We're here to, I'm not here to teach you what to think. We're here to teach you how to think."
Yeah.
And the best journalism in many ways is similar to that. You know, I don't want to hear a reporter. Now, the opinion pages are different, but I don't want to hear a reporter telling me what I need. I must think about a certain issue.
Or what you must not think about it.
Or what's, I just want to know the facts, and I want a good read.
Yeah,
I want a good narrative. I want you to take, and I always told my reporters, you know, we need to take the reader by the hand and walk them through this.
Yeah.
And it might be a really hard, you know, complicated story, or it might just be this wonderful tale.
Yeah.
And that was the beauty of being an editor, and I love being an editor, is you know, keeping that reader in mind. What are we going to do? How can we make an impact in a reader's life?
Yeah.
Not in a dictatorial way, but in a way that's just here.
Yeah, invites them greater freedom.
And that's the church.
Mm-hmm.
The church isn't telling me I must do this. I'm free to leave anytime I want.
Yeah. The church gives us a very small set of obligations and principles, but that it exhorts us to live out virtuous lives, which means we have to engage our freedom.
That's exactly right.
You know? I was thinking, actually, that, you know, there's a kind of connection with all this, back with that little stint of sort of libertarianism that you got into. And we, you know, that there's certainly ways in that ideology, way of thinking, that we can go too far. But there's some kernels there that are very important. It connects with the liberal arts education, right? What's the point of a liberal arts education? It's that it's to cultivate people who can freely think and choose and act. You know, not people of ideology, but people who can pursue the good through their own choices.
Well, and you're right. One of the kernels of libertarianism is putting the individual's humanity front and center.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where I eventually left is what you do with that humanity and how it's formed and what the real purpose of it is.
Right.
But the idea that human beings are here and God mm-hmm. created us and then what?
Yeah.
And what are we to do with that?
Mm-hmm.
And what are we to do with it as individuals? What are we to do with that in our relationships with other people?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we create a society that is focused on the beauty and the humanity of man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes people want from the church a church that is going to spell out every little jot and tittle of their life. What do I wear? How do I think? What do I speak? And the church is going to give you the revelation. It's going to give you the truth about who God is and what he's, you know, what your telos is, what you're oriented towards. But then it's going to exhort you to get out there and live out your journey, your story.
Right.
It can't tell you that.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, people think, oh, you know, you're converting to Catholicism. There's all these rules. There's all these things. It's like, okay, there are, but you know, you're free to pick and choose. And even if you don't do this, you can still be Catholic in a way. I mean, you can work it out with your priest or confession and those things. I mean, I'm not, you know, saying that, I mean, I'm not advocating sin, but the point is it's, you know, it's not as rule bound and hide bound as people think it is.
The world that we live in nowadays is full of lots of rules.
Again, that's exactly right.
What you're allowed to think, what you must not think, what you can question, what you can't question. The church, in some sense, is extremely conservative and cautious about what it obligates you to. It gives you the bare minimum. These are what you must believe. Here are the guidelines. But within here, then you have to live life. You have to make decisions.
Well,
you have to.
That's exactly right. And also, there's the idea that the church is so interested in everything, which appealed to me. And there's an example. I heard last night for the first time that the Vatican has somebody who's in charge of AI, thinking about AI.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The way the church has been involved in so many different, all aspects of Western life is very much a part of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah. We can make this bold claim from the church that there's no other institution in the world that is more interested in reality.
That's right.
And on trying to form individuals to have a right response to reality.
That's exactly
what
right.
being Catholic is all about. Now, Catholicism is going to also give us some of the key pieces of that God created you and he loves you and you have a savior.
Yeah.
But it's going to form you to be a person who embraces reality.
Well, and exactly right. And there are some fundamental things that you do have to believe in the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you know, we believe you're going to get to heaven and have our final reward. But again, it takes into account that the journey is long and interesting and arduous and joyful.
Right.
And all of those things, and an adventure.
Here at the Coming Home Network, you know, so again, connected to this show, you know, we produce this with EWTN, but in the background, we're working with people who are on the journey. And when someone comes to us that they're thinking about the Catholic Church, we never stop them right there and say, okay, right now you have to accept it all and you have to be done and you have to convert. No, we're, as my dad says, we never push, pull, or prod anybody into the church. Yeah. We're trying to help them take the next right step that the Holy Spirit's calling them to. Because, as you said, it's the journey.
Well, and it's interesting you say that, because I don't think there was ever anyone in my life, and I think about this, I think that's true, who ever said I should be Catholic. Mm. Nobody ever reached out and said, you know, you need to be Catholic, or you know, some president, you know, or you need to be Catholic, or you're going to hell, or you need to be this, you need to be that. Mm-hmm. It was just, I was around a lot of Catholics, and I really liked them.
Yeah.
And that, again, step by step by step. But nobody ever said I should. I mean, my friends would sometimes joke about, oh, come on, join the team and type of thing. But there was no, you know, and I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. I'm not saying we shouldn't evangelize.
Right.
But in my case, it was, I figured it out. And
you had some great witnesses.
That's
know.
Exactly right. I had the amazing witnesses, and I've been very blessed. And I don't take that for granted.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being here to be a witness to others. Kevin, we have just a couple minutes left, and again, if you would, there's somebody out there listening right now who's in journalism, you know, who comes from a background, kind of a nun that you were, but they, again, they have this yearning for truth and for freedom, and maybe they have questions about the Catholic Church. What's a word of encouragement that you could give to them?
Don't be afraid, and don't feel compelled by the social pressures to avoid that.
Yeah.
You know, listen. Listen to what's in your heart. Listen to what you're feeling. And it doesn't mean you have to take act on it immediately. And it doesn't mean you're a bad person if you don't. But listen, and then don't be afraid to be countercultural. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to stand up and say, yeah, this is what I believe. And it's okay. And it doesn't mean I can't be a part of society. It doesn't mean that... You know, it just means that you're following your conscience, you're following your soul, your heart. And that's what I would advise. I think it's very important.
Yeah, we believe as Catholics that God is the author of reality.
Yes.
Is the author of the world around us. He's the author of our own souls. And so there's something to that about, again, engaging deeply in recognizing those deep longings of your heart, looking at the world. And again, as you said, just keep taking those steps forward.
Yeah.
You know, seek truth. And God... If we knock, God will open the door if we don't give up.
That's right.
So, well, Kevin, thanks so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Praying for you and your continued journey of faith, you and your family. And I just appreciate you sharing.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, and thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. Again, Kevin's story is a great reminder, I think, to all of us that, again, we're all on a journey. The journey doesn't end when someone becomes Catholic or when they first came to Christ, when they first left, you know, a particular sin. The journey continues. We are a people, as Christians, we're a people who are on the way. We haven't arrived this side of heaven. We are on the way. And as long as we keep that in mind, Christ can keep leading us one step forward. And His grace is always building on our human nature, but it involves us continuing to take a step forward. So we must never give up, but we also have to keep in mind that we're on a journey. So we have to be open to the next steps that Christ is calling us to take. If you yourself are on a journey, you know, wherever you might be in relation to the Catholic Church, we'd love to be journeying with you. We'd love to be praying for you and praying with you. If you check out chnetwork.org, we have a monthly newsletter. We have an online community, retreats, and other things to help you continue to take these steps forward in faith. We'd love to hear about your journey. We'd love to help you and pray for you in any way we can. So check that out at chnetwork.org. And again, once again, we will be back here next week with another story to share with you here in EWTN. So in the meantime, God bless you. We'll see you then.